Hi, and welcome to the Ahead of the Herd podcast. I'm your host, Chris Herd. And this week, we've got a super guest. It's Cameron Etazadi. Cam has been building technology for many years. Well, not many years, you know, enough years, plenty of years. And he's been VP at Google, Amazon. He's VP at HashiCorp currently. Microsoft's on that list. SAP's on that list. Just a wealth of experience. So great to have you on. There's one thing you listed was former CIO of an S&P 500 firm. Maybe we can dive into that, but we'll dive into that in a second. Say hi to the people, Cam.
Howdy. Good to be here and nice to see you today up there in sunny Canada.
We actually got sun today for the first time. It's been like, I don't know what you call it, 40 degrees, like 12 Celsius in June. It's been horrible. So thanks for bringing
the sun. We call it January down here in Seattle.
I mean, you're not that far away.
No.
Let's be honest.
We're just like you guys, but not nearly as nice.
It was questionable, mate. Depends what you mean by nice, but thanks. I'll take it. All right. Well, first off, before we get into, we've got a few topics to cover off today, but I want to find out what this S&P 500 CIO job was. What was this all about?
Oh, I spent a year in Colorado as a CIO for a large multifamily real estate investment trust. That was an interesting time. You know, they were really going through some technological overhauls and advancements, which they were using to drive their operational costs and really move the platform forward. So I got a chance to build that for about a year with some great folks and got to see the Rockies up close and personal for a while.
That's awesome. That sounds really fun. Did you learn to fly there? He says, you know, I hear you're a pretty good pilot.
Pretty good is depends. I guess it's a subjective opinion, but no, I've been flying since 1994. I've got everything from single engine land, multi-engine sea, you name it, helicopters, gyroplanes. If it exists and gets off the ground, I probably fly it.
What happens if the doors fall off? What do you do then?
You know, funny, when I qualified and got my ATP, it was on a Boeing 737. And one of the very scenarios is a depressurization scenario. So you learn to fly that and we literally took off out of Portland and essentially depressurized and handled the emergency as part of the loft with line-oriented flight training prior to the check ride.
It was in Portland as well?
That was, yeah, believe it or not, I basically flew that scenario in my training. Well, I got to say the folks that actually handled that in the air did a brilliant job. Like their calm was not necessarily the same level as my calm during training, although the successful outcome was never in doubt.
Amazes me every time, like to be able to handle that kind of pressure, mate. I'm scared sitting on a plane, like flying it while that's going on. I don't know. I didn't want to talk about it because it's scaring me already. Good on you. Not something I'm going to learn. I'll stay on the ground, but I appreciate you for doing it, mate. All right. We should jump on to some topics, I think. We've got a lot to cover today.
Let's hit it.
So one of the first things, you know, you've been building engineering teams. For how long have you been in the business, Cam?
First real job was 1996, although I had definitely done some contract programming prior to that.
I've got to do some math.
So that's almost 30 years, right?
30 years, mate. That's just okay. About. And a lot of that hand-on engineering, working with engineering teams, kind of the whole gamut?
Everything from writing code. If you've ever used Windows 2000, there's code in there that I wrote. If you've ever bought a product from Amazon, there's code in there that I wrote. So, you know, it's been very hands-on, and I've tried to stay pretty hands-on with folks through the years because my belief is that builds credibility with your engineering teams. And when you can have those discussions, I feel like the engineers feel appreciated that you haven't lost touch with their own reality.
Beautifully said, mate. Totally awesome. I love it. However, is AI going to take all their jobs? So that's, I think that's one of the topics you want to talk about today. These co-pilots, I've seen them. It's crazy to me how much they can do. I've seen some startups with a single founder, no engineers, be able to get product out in a few months. Like just how much of the engineering job can actually be done by these co-pilots right now?
I think it's really impressive. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, it's really cool what you can do in a hurry. And for someone like me who's, you know, watch the gamut of languages run from, you know, C and C++ back in the day through Perl, you know, the one-offs like Julia along the way to the modern languages that we actually want to write in these days, which are basically Go and Rust, unless you're doing data science and those folks, of course, in Python. It's hard to maintain fluency. And it's hard to ramp up when you just need to do something quickly. And these tools are incredible for doing that. You know, I can crank out working code in a language I've never touched by and large in a few hours from zero. That blows my mind.
So is this exciting, scary, both? What do you think?
Oh, it's terrifying. You know, I was really blessed. If I give you a history lesson, Chris, I was really blessed as a teenager, a preteen. You know, I grew up in a school district. I went to public school in the Midwest. I was blessed to be in a school district that was very much at the technology forefront of things. You know, lots of computers. I remember being in kindergarten at 5 years old and programming in BASIC on like a PET. Commodore PET and an Apple II Plus. In fact, the really ugly looking Bell and Howell version of the Apple II Plus, if you're that much of a nerd. But we had the pleasure of working with Dr. Seymour Papert at MIT much later on, and he was one of the seminal folks behind AI. He and Marvin Minsky did a paper in the late 60s on the perceptron and really kicked off a lot of what we consider the foundations of AI. And that's super amazing to me. So I've been touching this, and I've watched it go through a couple of AI winters, and where we are right now is just incredibly exciting, the level of innovation, but it's petrifying the level of resources right now that it consumes to do this. And so, you know, someone who's got the scale to do this is, they're precious few, right? Few mega corporations, nation states. There are a lot of folks that can use this technology. But the number of folks and the power of those who can build it, it's really quite small.
That's interesting. Okay, so I was thinking more about just taking everybody's jobs and maybe, you know, the vacuum cleaner is killing us. But you're talking more about consolidation of the wealth and consolidation of the ownership of this technology. We could actually end up with a Skynet if we get enough M&A.
I mean, I wouldn't go that far. But, okay. But yeah, I mean, so if you want to, let's touch on the jobs thing. Like, I think it's really cool. I think it's an enabler. But what we're really seeing in the industry is it's helping the junior folks out, right? The folks without the knowledge bridge those gaps. It's not helping the senior folks out very much, the folks who've already learned that. And so one of my big worries is what happens to that learning curve where we use it as a crutch to avoid learning. Or, you know, are we using it as an accelerator or is it something that we're relying on because we can't?
Interesting. And then if something breaks, right? Like if we go back and we, you know, I find a lot of engineers' jobs. I'm not an engineer. Just want to like clear up a lot of the words that Cam said. I had no idea what he's talking about, but I'm sure the listeners really understood a lot of that language. That being said, I watch engineers a lot and I work with engineers closely. And one of the things that I'm always intrigued by is that so much of their job is actually just finding problems, right? They're going into it and figuring out what is this. And they spend so much time just sort of, it's an awesome job to just sit and scratch your head and try and solve things. So are you concerned that as we build more and more things with AI and we've got more junior people building things where the basic has been done by AI, going back and fixing those problems are going to be even more challenging without those that sort of talent that can actually dig into those problems?
Yeah, there's just going to be a widening gulf between the haves and the have-nots, I think, in this space. I think you've seen this previously. You know, one of the interesting things in my career was watching the rise of the offshore IT industry. We would get a lot of lower-skilled, lower-value jobs offshored, but the hurdle to get on that ladder and climb your way up wasn't too much to hit that first rung. But as technology's advanced, right, those lower rungs are being cut out there and there's an ever higher bar and ever higher skill set to jump on. AI lowers that, but I don't know if they've greased the rungs above you, like, so you can't climb it because it's too slick.
Yeah, that's okay. So maybe we're in a transition period at best, right? I think is kind of where you're at. And speaking of those transition periods, you know, you've been around and you've seen bubbles. You know, you saw the 2000 tech bubble. I'm sure you were right in the middle of it, right? When the 2000 stuff was happening, you were in, where were you working at the time?
I was at Microsoft. I remember being up all night on call for Y2K, which was, I mean, at the time, I too could see that it was a lie, right? It was a joke. It was a paranoid reaction to mass hysteria, a lot of which is probably going on right now in relation to AI as well. But, you know, yep. There were some very real things. The impact was not so real.
So, yeah, the impact of Y2K for sure, but I think the economic impact of the crash that happened in the 2000s when we had sort of the massive internet boom, which is the only thing I can kind of connect this AI explosion to is that 2000s where we just had, you know, pets.com is obviously the big one. I think there were, you know, people selling all sorts of random stuff on websites. Are we looking at a similar sort of hype cycle where I genuinely believe the internet has changed the world, and the AI is going to do the same thing. Just the way the internet had a massive explosion, then a crash, and then settled in to be probably the most transformative technology 100% in my lifetime, maybe ever. I feel like AI can do the same thing, but are we in the same trajectory? And do you think it's going to suffer that same hype to crash to normalization? Or is this just here to stay? Is NVIDIA going to be the biggest company in the world forever? What do you think?
Oh, I don't know if NVIDIA will be the biggest company forever, although I certainly wish I'd bought more stock earlier in it.
Yeah.
Don't we all? I think it's really important. I think we're going to hit that trough of disillusionment again. Right? We always do go and hit it. We're definitely in a hype cycle, right? There's been stupid money pumped into a lot of startups with some really bad ideas over the last couple of years around this that don't understand what the market is, right? They are doing things that are easily disintermediated because they're users of it, and they don't realize that this is a powerful tool that can do absolutely incredible things. Right, but the value is learning how to apply that to a business model or a problem space that you already have. Right, it's not the answer; it's a tool for getting to the answer. And I think that's where a lot of this problem comes out. It's a neat party trick. I'm actually hoping the market froth kind of goes away a bit here, and we start seeing some real values come out. But there's not a lot of killer apps out there, per se, for this. It's a really useful technology. Honestly, Chris, tending to liken this a lot to one of the previous transitions, which is the rise of the graphical user interface. And we went from a text-based modality into a very visual point-and-click type of paradigm for interaction. This technology brings us to a point where there's a new paradigm for interaction, right? Where we've changed how our modality of how we interact with the system, and that's really cool because those are quantum leaps. The other thing that it does is the back end and the ability to search and index in a way that's not necessarily precise, as we know.
Sure.
I'm being kind about the drug trips. Yeah. Right. But it's really rapid and it's unstructured. And that is incredibly cool to me as well.
I really like that idea of the GUI, like the user interface. It really is different. I mean, I do liken some of my success in life, not that it's been wildly successful, but, you know, relatively, to being able to Google. Like, I just learned how to Google pretty early on. I had the internet really early. My stepdad got me a compact Presario, and I was, you know, whatever, downloading Simpsons GIFs. But Simpsons icons it was, not even GIFs, right? But that ability to Google was something that it made you, like, a genius. For a time, you knew everything, and it took other people so long to find things out. We were at the same space here, and to your point earlier of not necessarily just engineers, where the people that have spent all this time learning how to build certain things and how to code in certain languages, they're kind of getting left behind a little bit, and the newer juniors can learn. Society as a whole has operated for the last 10 years around, like, the internet a lot. a lot of society has operated about how fast can you get information from the internet, and people that have been able to search things, get information and learn fast have been able to progress faster. And I feel like maybe we're in that same spot where even societally, older generations that have lived on even just Google, even just search, now have to learn how to leverage AI and get information now, because you're going to get left, otherwise you're just left behind. It's scarier. It's not even just engineers should be scared. So we all should be scared of AI is basically what you're saying.
Well, I mean, there's a couple bits here. So, like, the simpler question to answer, right, is how good is your stepdad at differentiating truth from fiction when he gets a Google result?
That's fair. Right?
Yeah. Right? What kind of security and safety, you know, does he bring to the table? And I don't know your stepdad, I'll be honest. He raised you.
Great.
So I,
yeah, well, Al, he, by the way, very important part of my life, Morris, if you're listening. Fantastic. Love the compact.
I mean, he raised you, so it's kind of suspect, right? But yeah. in all fairness, Chris, like, you know, we have a generation of folks who either haven't mastered that skill of safety and security or are just mastering it. And we've just flipped this all on its head. So that is worrisome. The existential question to me, though, is, you know, as someone like myself who spent a lot of his career, getting ahead by learning quickly. My wife will joke, I have a photographic memory, and I still can't remember her birthday.
Just never took a photo.
Exactly. what was your name again?
That's something.
But a lot of the stakes in my life that have pushed me forward have been the ability to memorize, understand, and synthesize a lot from that information, right? And this value is now encoded into a machine. What does that mean existentially for my value, and what skills do I need to be able to translate things into my own personal growth and expansion?
Wow. There's a lot to think about. And, my dad just got a hold of the internet, right? And he's just learning that. And you're right. That is one of the security, I think, is such an interesting part of it, because that moves so fast. I mean, I'm so shocked with how fast cybersecurity companies have to move and then how fast hackers are able to catch up. I've only been subject to one phishing attempt that worked. It was like a Google Drive one years ago. But it was very sophisticated, very sophisticated. And now in this world, I think we'll get on to some recent security breaches later, but I'm interested in your thoughts. What are some of the more pressing security concerns? Let's talk about personal data first, and we can talk about business data after. From this new wave of AI, what are some of the personal security concerns that we should be thinking about?
I mean, I wish I studied more philosophy, right? But it's, what is truth anymore, right? We can't believe voices. We can't believe video. They're still detectable at the moment. But as these continue to get better, how do I even know I'm talking to you today?
Yeah.
And a lot of it is trust. I mean, this is what it really boils down to, is what does it mean in the brave new world to trust someone or something?
That's a big one, mate. I don't know. And you're definitely talking to me. You can tell because it's kind of dry. not the most interesting conversation. So I think AI would maybe do a better job. But I think that's a really interesting one. Let's think about this. What are businesses doing? Let me ask this question a different way. Phishing and these kind of hacks where people are trying to get information out has often come through business, right? There's a lot of that will like easily, oh, it's a massive company. My name gets pushed out is like, hey, Chris, the CEO needs you to go to the Apple store, whatever it might be. It comes through the business. And so we build these firewalls and protections that prevent that happening. What are businesses doing to prevent this sort of AI manipulation, this imitation? And is there anything that we can learn from what businesses are doing that we can then bring into the more consumer world?
Oh, I think that's really interesting. I don't know. I don't have a good sense of the space per se, right? We tend to believe we can combat this through education, right? I just went through my annual corporate compliance and security training. It feels like it's probably 10 years out of date, to be honest. Yeah. Between you and me, I think there's a special seat reserved in hell for those who make HR training videos.
You, me, and everyone listening to this, but yeah, sure.
Yeah, right. It was pretty painful, not going to lie. And then we are deploying, obviously, more sophisticated AI-driven tools to analyze inbound emails. I'm assuming that we do some of this for inbound instant messages, whether you use Slack or texting or other tools out there, right? I don't think any of it's perfect. I think there's a much more comprehensive set of threat detection and signals that need to be fed in. But one thing AI is really good at is pulling together signals out of a large amount of noise very, very quickly. I'm not an expert in this space by any means, but this is a pattern matching and signal extraction problem that AI is very, very good at.
And it does feel to me like the ability for AI to imitate and make fake stuff is moving significantly faster than the ability to detect it. That I think is the scariest thing. It almost feels like a lot of traditional cybersecurity and data breaches, they do move in kind of lockstep. You'll get the bad actors move first, and then the good actors will catch up pretty quick, or the good actors will be ahead of things. But this one feels like we're pretty cat out of the bag in terms of that ability. Like, again, I'm not an expert either, but in terms of my ability to create a fake voice or a fake video, seems way beyond any technology's ability to detect it or Well, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong because I'm obviously not in the space, but that's one thing that really scares me. Is it just feels a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of the tools the bad actors have versus the tools of the people trying to protect people.
Well, let's put the tools aside for a second. Let's posture out here that you could already detect this, right? Let's just say that detection works for on a technical level, right? Someone sophisticated in an IT department of a, you know, Fortune 50 could do it. What about the damage before it's detected? So great court case in the US a few months back, there was a Republican official who was basically creating a deep fake, telling people not to vote, right? It was a lie imitating a politician on the other side. I'm kind of deliberately being vague here, but
okay.
you get the case. And he was punished in the court system, right? But the number of robocalls he made with this AI-driven voice that was very convincing, right? You pick up the phone, you're not going to analyze this.
Sure.
Right? Think of the damage that was done before anybody was you know, aware of it. There's a learning principle called the principle of primacy, which, you know, says that the first thing you learn is the thing you remember. It takes 7 times more effort to undo the principle of primacy than it is to teach something right in the first place. So imagine if I imprinted something on you and you find out it's fake later, right? I have to work that much harder to overcome it. So you don't even have to be able, let's say everything's perfect. You don't have to be able to detect it to do damage with it.
Yeah, that sucks.
I mean, what worries me? No, I mean, honestly, you're worried about the programmers. I'm worried about what kind of propaganda do we see from nation states? And you're seeing this come out from, you know, particularly the Russians right now, but they're not the only ones. You're seeing this come out from our side too in like use cases. You know, it's an endless propaganda machine.
Okay, let's. Well, we're still on kind of security. I was going to talk about security.
I'm bringing it down.
That's pretty exciting. It's okay. Let's switch it just quickly before we move off the topic.
Yeah.
What are the this ability to create? Let's talk about something positive. But this ability to create content, to create even like full movies and that ability to create content. What are some of the amazing positive impacts that we think it's going to have? Let's start with business because I think that's one of the most important starts for us.
I think there's a lot of cost reduction that's going to come out of this, a lot of efficiencies of operations. So you're going to see a lot of business models that were unable to be profitable, right? Going concerns, where by deploying this technology with fewer workers to be able to deliver it, you have viable solutions, which will bring great products and, you know, great niches that'll get satisfied by this. That's really cool. I think rapid innovation using this technology is amazing. You yourself a few moments ago talked about getting a product out in only a couple of months.
Yeah.
You can get apps built in an hour now. I mean, that's unheard of. I don't even know in the old days, like years ago when, you know, everybody programmed in Visual Studio and you had a wizard that would create an app for you. I don't know if you ever saw this back in the day.
I mean, I don't think either for websites.
Yeah, there you go. Right. I don't think you could click through it as fast as you can almost get an app out these days.
That is true. I like the sort of ability to be profitable in, you know, a lot of these startups that are trying to build things. It has historically been almost impossible for them to get profitable, to build that sort of level of business up front because the engineering costs are just so high. And like you said, right, engineering costs, just like you were talking about the ability to run scalable actual AI, like owning the AI, okay, that's going to be a few companies. But the ability to build technology, that used to be also a few companies that could afford the engineers. The hiring in, you know, 4 years ago, it was so challenging to hire talent unless you were paying incredible amounts of cash that Amazon and Google can pay. So yeah, that's a good point. I think it'll help the little people try and build, or the little guy, I don't know what we say, the small startups to build stuff. You know what I'm trying to say.
Well, and it's not just the building too. I mean, you're an entrepreneur. You're successful. You have sales teams, marketing teams. What if you could run 10 campaigns simultaneously because it didn't cost you more than it cost you to run one campaign today, right? Yeah. See what hits. See if you can get your product and your name and your vision out there. AI is great for analyzing huge troves of data. Think about as you build your product out and you refine the product vision based on customer feedback. I used to have a lot of people to sift through that customer feedback. I can get the TLDR in minutes.
I mean, we're supposed to be positive, but I can't help but think of the multiple layoffs that have been happening as well because of this. So I don't know, like, yes, kind of positive, but there's also like some downside.
It's brutal. It's brutal, right? And I you know, and I'm not going to sound like a Luddite here, right? But when you think about things, you know, we repurpose humans to better, higher causes, things that were menial work that can be automated, right? It's not that those jobs went away, but not the need for people, right? There were other things. You know, the quintessential example is, you know, manufacturing line automation. We took those unskilled workers and we taught them how to fix the manufacturing lines. You know, we found other jobs for them to do that created meaningful work. And, you know, I'm not saying it's everybody's job to find that. It's people's job to find their own meaningful work. Education is the answer. But there are things that will have to be done and will always have to be done.
Yeah, I just feel like this one's a little bit different. Aside from like there's a bathroom cleaning robot that I don't think anybody's going to complain about. That's great. But this one is a little different in terms of it's the brain. I don't think it is there's ever been a technological advance that has taken people's jobs that has been this aggressive at taking the one thing that makes us human above other animals, which is our brain power. And that's the thing that I think I always concerns me is, you know, and I'm not that I'm worried about lawyers, like lawyers I'm sure are fine, but when it's starting to take those highly educated brain jobs, it does feel a little bit more existential than some of the previous ones, and it feels like it will be a lot more challenging at least to find. Yes, it is going to create other jobs, totally appreciate that. However, like, is it going to create as many jobs as it takes, I think, is the question.
I don't know the answer to that, but I think, you know, every time we've been on a technological inflection point, we've always come out ahead, like throughout history. And it's always felt like this sense of existential dread. You know, I did use the term Luddite a few minutes ago, right? Those guys went out and smashed factories, right? Because they were afraid of the automation and the mechanized taking of their jobs, right? But
I can see another Luddite. I can see it come back, man. I could totally see that happening.
I think you need to look at it. I mean, I think there's certainly that's the fear way to look at it. But I think you need to look at it, too, in some of the paradigm shifts we've gone through recently, although I think this one is more monumental, of things like cloud, right? For instance, the move to cloud democratized the ability to set up an IT infrastructure and a product platform and made it super cheap, quick, and easy, right? I can have my company's infrastructure running in an afternoon in AWS or GCP, right, as a cloud backer, right? Yep. That used to take me ordering hardware, waiting on vendors, making a lease for data center space, buying the software, installing it manually on machines. If I was lucky, I had an imager, right? This was a very expensive process. Now it's cheap, right? It cost me just to run my own, you know, business. And I say that lightly, let's call it my home / LLC / everything. We're running at like $40 a month, right? Between my web apps, my entire infrastructure, my backups of everything. I mean, most of that's storage and transfer costs, to be honest.
Wow. Okay. And what you're saying there is there's still a lot of IT people. In fact, there's a lot more IT people managing. Even, I mean, maybe less network guys? Are there more network guys, less since cloud?
It's a different kind of network guy, right? SDNs are the goal. Like I came out, I just owned, one of the things I owned when I was at Google was I owned Istio, which is, if you're, you know, a Kubernetes kind of guy, if you're into Kubernetes, you're kind of it's the network layer, the service mesh layer, right? The connectivity between pieces. And as the owner for that, you know, we went from I physically cable things together, I put them on multiple VLANs, to I software define how these things talk to one another. And yeah, there's a few very, very skilled guys working at very high volume places who can do this. But most of that you don't need to know anymore. You have abstracted it away and you're like, I just need to connect this to this and a couple lines in a YAML file and life is good.
All right. That's giving us hope. I like it.
Yeah.
All right. Bit of positivity. there was one topic that we're going back to. We're back to negative. Don't worry. We're not going to be positive for much longer. I wanted to talk about, there have been some recent security breaches. And the reason why I wanted to bring these up, a couple of things. One, I don't know if this is big in the US, but in Canada, 23andMe, the Canadian government and the UK government are investigating the 23andMe DNA breach. So that kind of brought that to my attention. And then I'm also an avid Ticketmaster fan. So that one wasn't great. I don't use Truist Bank, but Truist Bank was, there just seems to, is this that we're, I almost feel like the plane issues is a lot of extra coverage and maybe it's a little overblown. It feels like there's a lot of security stuff that's happening right now. Or is this just me not paying enough attention and this is happening all the time?
I think it's you not paying enough attention. No, I you set yourself up and walked right through that door.
That's fine.
And I think we're more aware of it. You know, as more of the world's moved online, you know, you can't function in some places without a smartphone. Let's be honest. We're all, you know, we've now got a significant cohort of folks alive on this planet who have only grown up that way. We're more attuned to it than it was. You know, it's certainly been a growing and ever increasing space. And this just goes back to, you know, the consequences of some very small actions. The consequences of one weak link in the chain can take the whole thing out. You know, and as you see with some of these breaches, you know, Ticketmaster might have done everything right, but a vendor, you know, had a kink in the armor, so to speak.
So let me ask you this. With all these the kinks in the armor, the amount of money that goes into cybersecurity. So anytime I look at tech investment and CIO investment forecasts from whoever that is that's doing the analysis, cybersecurity is always top of the list. Like, it, and it keeps growing and getting more and more and more. We're investing so much into cybersecurity. Why? How is it that these companies, if this is still happening year over year, there's constant security breaches. So if we're investing so much into security technology, why isn't it working?
I think complexity comes with cost. Things are ever more complicated than they were. I mean, I can, you know, I remember back in college, I had a 10 megabit network tap in the wall of the residence hall I was living in.
Okay.
And I was running Linux as all good humans did in the day. It was
the old network guys, right?
Oh, dude, I'm old school, man. This was so it was kernel 0.96, patch level 7, on a stack of like 15 floppy disks that I dutifully had sat at a Spark station overnight and like downloaded and burned so I could get off of Windows and onto something that I trusted. It was compiling my own kernel every night. Like, it was good stuff back in the day. But we plugged that machine right into the internet.
Okay.
Like, there was no firewall. There was no proxy. There was nothing. And so the interesting story about this, and not to digress too much, is there was a series of toolkits. And I was really early into this, and I deployed those toolkits. And so I was at least watching who was trying to get to my machine. Now, you know, it's terrifying now to think of it, but, you know, this is 30 years ago. It was a kindler, gentler world. And one of the IT guys at the university decided that he was going to scan the whole network for vulnerabilities.
Okay.
So he's using a guy named Dan Farmer, wrote a toolkit. I think it was called Satan at the time. He was a Silicon Graphics guy. No, it's true. Like, it's, and so he used this toolkit to basically scan everything within, you know, the IP range of the university. And I saw these pop up in my log. So, you know, I went down the next morning when I was between classes to, and I knew who the guy was, you know, yell at him like, you know, WTF are you doing trying to get into my machine? You know, that's when I found out he scanned the whole network. He goes, you know, I did this for the entire network of the university, 4,000 undergrads, you know, faculty, et cetera. He goes, you're the only person who's come to me and said anything about it.
Because you're the only one that noticed or the only, one that cared?
Only one that noticed. Right. And so this is sort of a, there's a sort of a bias here that you're seeing, I think, with it. But also, the world's a lot more complicated now, right? We have multiple levels in the stack. We've distributed the responsibility for the chain. Humans are still the weakest link, right? Whether it's a spear phishing attack or some other sort of vulnerability. But, you know, it's a geometric, you know, combination here. It's not additive. It's, you know, there's a 10% risk here, there's a 10% risk there. You multiply them through. And so there's just a lot more places to get in, and where where blast radii of breaches are not engineered correctly, you have these situations.
It doesn't sound like it's slowing down, mate. I think it feels like cybersecurity is going to continue. I mean, the more that we rely on technology, the more people are going to try and use technology to take advantage and find holes, and the more we have to invest in security to stop them, right? Like, that is, if I always think about this as a salesperson. If I'm looking for career, like, longevity, cybersecurity is, like, one of the only areas I feel like it's pretty safe that's not going anywhere, right? That's like a government, that's the government job of tech sales jobs, is selling cybersecurity.
I think it's even better because, you know, the good news, for better or worse, if you can call anything about a politician good news, is, you know, there are laws now that, you know, breaches have to be reported. There's penalties for some of these poor cybersecurity practices that we've seen out there, right? All of those are healthy and driving business, right? That creates market opportunity that has a guaranteed payday for all practical purposes.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same with the military, right? I mean, the military is there to protect the country, and a lot of money goes into the military, and we're kind of, you know, it's just going to keep going. It's an interesting world that I always found kind of dry when I was starting out in tech, and the more and more I get into it, I'm more and more intrigued by security. All right, last thing before we're coming up to time. So I do want to ask you, as in your role as VP of engineering, what are some of the things moving forward in the next 6 months, 12 months, any other VP of engineering leads that are looking at their tech stack, looking at some advances, gaps, what are some of the things that you think they should be investing in now, whether that's process or whether that's technology solutions that will inevitably have to be addressed that maybe they aren't today, to stay ahead of the curve and make sure that they're covering the bases?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we're still, you know, sitting there at a point where we're evaluating the integration of AI. What does it mean? And what can we do with it? I think the bets are still out there. There's arms races going on every day between various companies and various models. I question how much of those are actually valuable. I mean, other than in a bragging rights scenario, for the true application of this. And there's still a lot of flexibility you've got to use as, you know, models update or vendors change, the same prompts and other, you know, sort of, we used to call it prompt engineering, but I think that term's already should fall out of favor and we're only months into it. We used to call it prompt engineering, right? It changes. It doesn't give you the same results. So, you know, what are the new techniques that are coming out there that you can use to get the consistent results? And back to the point of the beginning of this podcast, you know, what can you do to engender trust in the results that come out? And so what are you not looking at from an engineering point of view? I'm looking at what can I do to build trust in this technology, not to just say that I'm using it, but to say that I'm using it for good in my product and using it to build trust in customers, in process, in engineering outcomes, and to create repeatability out of that too as well, so that we do the same thing every time, which I think goes back into trust.
I love it. Little high level, how are you doing it, Cam? Right, like build trust, but like, are there some processes, or is that secret sauce? Can't share that out.
You know, we're in a really interesting part, and I'm not going to talk. I'm going to talk on behalf of me, not necessarily on behalf of the company. We're at an interesting inflection point in our journey and our ownership structure. You can read the proxy statements, of course, if you want. So I've just got a lot of work in that area. That, you know, regardless of all the AI out there, this is just some good old fashioned corporate M&A activities that are going on.
If there's one thing that's going to keep IT people in a job, it's M&A activity and trying to integrate companies into each other, like 100%. Cybersecurity or working for companies that are acquiring companies, that's your golden ticket, I think.
You know, Chris, if you're going to use AI for something, everybody does M&A. They do a lot of the A, and they're usually pretty bad about the M part. Let's use AI to fix that M part.
That's a great way to leave it, mate. Let's fix the M. It was great to chat to you today, mate. Have a great weekend. I know it's a big week for you lot next week, Canada Day. Of course, you're excited about it. So have a great Canada Day, mate.
Woohoo. I will pour some maple syrup on my waffles for you.
Sounds perfect. And I'll release an eagle on Wednesday.
Can I shoot it? No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
Okay, we'll cut it off there. Thanks, Cam. Speak to you soon, mate.
Take care.
Ciao. Bye.